You're tuned to 90.7 KRWG Las Cruces. I'm Leora Zeitlin. It is my great pleasure to welcome back to KRWG pianist John Nakamatsu, here for the third time performing with the Las Cruces Symphony Orchestra, and Lonnie Klein, who I've had on in other contexts, but not in one of these interviews.
I've been on sabbatical.
You have been on sabbatical.
I did fundraising for you.
Exactly, but our fearless conductor. So welcome to you both.
Thank you.
So this is the final concert of the season, and we got a little bit of a Scandinavian thing going on.
Well, the last two concerts, seemingly, yeah.
Yeah, but we've got music of Edvard Grieg and of Carl Nielsen, and mm-hmm. we'll talk about them both. But let's go to Edvard Grieg. John Nakamatsu, this is I want to talk about the piece first, then we'll talk a little bit about what you're up to these days. You know, I think of Edvard Grieg, and I think of all these beautiful little lyric pieces, little miniatures, and he's got a few great orchestral things like Peer Gynt, but this concerto, which he was pretty young, it's his only concerto.
The only one.
And yep. He wrote it when he was young. It continues to be so famous. It's fabulous piece. And kind of unique, therefore, in his repertoire and in the world. So tell me your thoughts about the Grieg Piano Concerto.
Well, he wrote it when he was very young. I think he was about 24 in 1868, and he actually presented it to Liszt, and Liszt thought it was fantastic, and really thought Grieg was the type of composer he admired himself. And there's that famous anecdote where he played through the piece at a gathering, just kind of sight reading it through the score. And
Liszt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and would, you know, just call out praises in front of his guests. And but Grieg, I think, was very smart, and he took many of Liszt's suggestions, but also ignored a few. There's this, in fact, a beautiful cello moment in the first movement where the cellos introduced the second theme, and that was originally Liszt's idea to introduce with trumpets, and Grieg said, you know, no, I think I'm going to go back to the cellos. So, but he continued to revise this piece until I think just a couple years before his death, and that's the version that we most commonly play now. There are older versions and a couple of recordings of them, but you know, he felt that the material was worthy of his attention his whole life, and I think that says something about the piece as well as you know, his own opinion of it.
Yeah, but odd that he never wrote any other concertos for any other instrument.
Very true. You often wonder. I mean, it's the same thing with Brahms. You know, you wonder why he didn't write another piano sonata after, you know, age 20, whatever. So I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that it was an instant success and that it really, really boosted his career, both as a pianist and as a composer. And I think when you hear the opening 2 seconds, you'll know why.
Yeah, fantastic piece. But it just, you know, Liszt, just for a minute, it's interesting that he gave a suggestion that was not so smart. He was a great mentor to many young artists of his time. He's sort of famous as being one that if you got into his good graces, it could really help your career.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it did for Grieg.
What's interesting about the Grieg to me is when you hear the Peer Gynt and the lyric pieces, the writing for the piano concerto is so different. Then it's you know, it's powerful, that opening. Everyone recognizes the opening, and it has that sort of the broad chords that Liszt would, you would get like in a Liszt or a Rachmaninoff. So kind of forward thinking for his time. And again, I think, as John mentioned, totally different than any other style of writing that he had.
Yeah, and the only one. So John Nakamatsu, when we first interviewed, which was many, many years ago, early on Lonnie Klein's and my career, we came the same. I got into the music on the radio business right around when Lonnie came to Las Cruces. He was my first interview. So you rather famously won the Van Cliburn, 1997?
Oh, yes, a while ago.
And you were a high school history teacher?
German teacher. Yeah.
Okay, German teacher. And never went back because you've had this wonderful career for almost 20 years now as a soloist, as a concert artist and chamber musician and various other activities. So now 19 years into and recording artist too, big career. What has surprised you? You know, I interviewed you when you were much closer to that beginning. And now, you know, you're well into it. And so I'm just curious, what are some of the highlights or what has surprised you as a musician 20 years later?
Well, I think the biggest surprise is how fast the time has gone. You know, I still feel like in some ways I just came from that win and that you're still riding that wave, but really it's been long gone. And in fact, all the people at the Clyburn that I knew are now gone. So it's a different world and it's a different time. But I think why it feels so almost so immediate is because what I'm doing is somewhat timeless. And you feel that we're, you know, I feel that I'm in this bubble of music and getting to work with wonderful musicians like Lonnie and the orchestra and you know, people that I really love making music with, and that just makes the time go by so fast. I'm not sure that I had any delusions about the career from the beginning, because I was an older Clyburn winner, you know, so I knew what it was like, and I knew that the business wasn't always nice, but I also knew that all I wanted to do was play, and I think that, you know, you find a way somehow to keep going, and I just feel so lucky every time I get to walk on a stage.
Which you get to do a lot, which is nice.
I do it a lot.
Now, my guess is that over these years, you have now sat in the judge's seat once or twice at a competition. What's that like for you as somebody who really was launched through a competition? Many artists are.
Well, the funny thing is that most of us really don't like competitions, and we go to these things and we expect, you know, you hear something, you think, wow, that's obviously a winner or that's obviously not a winner. And then something happens and the person you didn't think anything of suddenly is in the next round. And I think all of those surprises are things that you have to just accept as part of the game. And we've all played it on both sides, you know, and there's no accounting for taste. And even though we base our judgment on something that we consider conviction or academics or whatever you want to call it, there's no science to it, and there's no way to quantify how any one person thinks about something that is inherently subjective. So if you go into competitions as a competitor or as a judge thinking that you're going to go with your gut and do what you want to do, that's really the only way to survive either way, because in both cases you can become very angry when you understand how things sometimes turn out, especially if they don't turn out for you, but if they don't turn out the way you envision. That's just, you know, our business. And in fact, it continues well after these competitions are done, because, you know, Lonnie and I now compete for jobs all over the place with people who have been doing this for far longer than we have. So it doesn't end. It just takes on a different form.
Do you think I've had this conversation that the recording industry has sort of changed the way people play, because and our expectations of musicians, because every single note that might be misplayed, you know, there might be a mistake in a recording studio can be engineered so that the recording sounds absolutely perfect. So now we expect the kind of, but it also sometimes takes away, some people argue, from the individuality of the musician, having to make everything recording level perfect for either a competition or for a performance. And I'm just curious where you stand on that debate, if there is a debate. Has the playing of music changed?
I think the playing of music has changed even before electricity. You know, I think that instruments changed, and so playing changed. And then the people, cultures, generations are different, and so naturally there is always a kind of departure from what is traditional. And I think there hasn't been a generation that says, I don't know what's going to happen these kids, you know, what do they know about, but somehow it survives. And I think that's part of the relevance of this music, you know, it's surviving despite what we might do to it, and it may not be its original intent, and it may never sound like it did when Mozart played, but it sounds meaningful in a way to us. So I don't necessarily think that these changes have been wholly negative. I mean, I see the point of losing some sort of individuality and willfulness, but in a way, recordings have sharpened our skills as technicians and have made us more aware of listening to ourselves in ways that people pre-recordings couldn't. So that doesn't necessarily speak to authenticity or an academic look at music, but it does speak to your own skill and your own taste as a performer. That said, I think there is a certain spontaneity and almost individual sound that may not exist anymore in pianists and in other instrumentalists, because they're really looking for this one idealized recorded kind of sound. But that's why, to me, there's recordings and there are still live performances, because I think they're two very different arenas. Mm-hmm. And I think they can work very well in tandem, because, you know, for us as performers, recordings can be almost an idealized version of an interpretation, whereas a performance can't always. A performance is largely left up to, you know, what happens in the rehearsals on stage with the instrument, the audience, the hall. So in some ways, it's like maybe watching a painter in the process of creating a work versus going to the museum and seeing it once he's done. Mm-hmm. Two different aspects of really the same art, and I find them both very, very valid.
Okay, very, very beautifully articulated, and a great argument for both being in the concert hall and hearing recordings.
Well, and I've heard live recordings mm-hmm. that are stunning.
Yes, mm-hmm. because that Absolutely. Does have that spontaneous, mm-hmm. you don't know what's going to happen
well,
next.
Well, as a matter of fact,
moment.
I just heard Boston Symphony Orchestra recording of Shostakovich's 10th, and it's amazing. Mm-hmm. It's scary right, perfect, right. And it was a live performance.
Yes, and it just won the Grammy. I think it won a Grammy.
It won a Grammy, yeah.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, excellent. All right, Lonnie Klein, let's just talk a little bit about the other couple of pieces. So we have the Edvard Grieg Piano Concerto, and you've got a little visit to Rome via mm-hmm. Hector Berlioz, the Roman Carnival, which is a wonderful upbeat overture.
Wonderful. It's a wonderful overture. One of my favorites.
And mine too, and fast. And then you've got the Aladdin Suite. Is that what you're...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The Carl Nielsen Aladdin Suite.
Talk a little bit about that piece.
Well, that's an interesting piece. I didn't know it. Actually, my conducting coach, Leon Gregorian at Michigan State, had mm-hmm. recommended it a couple of years ago. So I started digging in, found out that it was actually written in 1919. Not very successful. It's long. It took two nights to perform. And Nielsen walked out of the production because he didn't get along with the director and the choreographer mm-hmm. because they extrapolated movements and rearranged and reorchestrated. And as a matter of fact, it collapsed in 15 days. But what Nielsen did do was...
It was in an opera?
Yes,
originally,
opera, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. What he did do was pull out some of the best music and made a suite out of it. And this is actually seven movements, and it's basically a set of dance movements. And they all have different characters. Chinese dance, Hindu dance, Oriental dance is the opening. African dance at the end, and then Dance of the Prisoners. So these obviously had moments in the opera where they were significant, but there's no real... programmatic connection. But I have to tell you, the most interesting movement is the fifth movement. It's basically a conversation. It's the only movement that's not a dance. It's conversations, and it takes place in a bazaar north of Baghdad in Iran, actually Isfahan, the second largest city, and it's a cacophony. So there's four orchestras, orchestra 1, 2, 3, and 4. They come in individually, and then as you would be in a bazaar, and at one moment you have four different melodies, four different groups playing this cacophony like you would hear in a bazaar, and then we fade out 4, 3, 2, 1 in terms of the orchestra. So it's pretty ingenious writing. It's very colorful. It's not like anything you would hear from like the Nielsen Clarinet Concerto or some of the larger works as symphonies. It's much more accessible, I think. Hmm. And actually the orchestra embraces it. It's fun. It's tuneful.
It's so interesting. I just have to, you know, we think of a suite, like a Baroque suite was a suite of dances, mm-hmm. and it might be a French courant and a German allemande and an Irish gigue and, you know, the European dances. Then you come into the 20th century, mm-hmm. And we already, even at the beginning of the 20th century, a much more global sense of the music that they had access to. And so here you have
these dance movements.
Persian and Hindu and Chinese.
Well, and the sixth movement is Dance of the Prisoners.
Oh,
and that's,
okay.
That is really bombastic, but it's, you can imagine being in a prison in the Middle East in, say, 400 years ago. So you've got this real, almost kind of like Rite of Spring-ish, Stravinsky kind of sound, but it's still tonal. But you can feel the angst of the music. You can feel the desperation of the prisoners. And then it quietly ends in D major, as if they either escaped or they accept their fate. One does not know. And then it ends with the African dance, which is primal in it, primal as well. Lots of percussion, and you can just hear this sense of sacrificial dance once again of the Rite of Spring. So it's a nice piece. I think the audience is really going to enjoy it. And as I said, the orchestra has embraced it, and it's something we've never done.
Yeah, yeah. So. And very interesting counterpart to the Grieg. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Very romantic era piano concerto. The concerts are tonight, tonight's the open rehearsal, Friday mm-hmm. open rehearsal. Tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Atkinson Recital Hall, Sunday at 3, it's the Las Cruces Symphony Orchestra, Lonnie Klein conducting, and my guest today, John Nakamatsu at the piano. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you, Leora.